It's hit in the air to right field, and that's deep, and it's gone! A big fly for Jimmy Crooks. His first hit in the big leagues is a big fly here at Great American Ballpark, and the Cardinals are within one. A 3-2 pitch, and he hammered it.
That was a big fly by Jimmy Crooks, the Cardinal rookie now? Catcher.
Yeah,
he's one of five catchers, I think, that have are on this roster. It's pretty amazing.
It's a big fly.
It was a big fly.
And you know, we got a big guest joining us right now.
Indeed, we do.
Is there any bigger guest in KMOX right now than the next person we're going to talk to?
Well, he's Matt Pauly. And do we have an intro for Matt? Person. Don't we have an intro for Matt Pauly? Hey, Pauly, give me the whatever. James is looking for the...
Hey, Pauly, what are you doing?
That's enough.
Can't you talk baseball?
Yeah, that's enough of that. Hey, Matt Pauly, are you there?
We're off to a great start here.
Yeah. Buddy, this is seamless. We like to...
Live radio on a holiday, man.
We like to, you know, we like to show up on the holidays because nobody else does, and here we are. And you doing extra, over and above the call of duty. By joining us here on KMOX on the Chris and Amy show, neither of which are here today. But Matt, Cardinals have taken two out of three of the last two series. That's good news.
Yeah, they're probably not playing for a whole lot at this point in time. But it's good to see. This is a team that, you know, it sounds cliche, but they haven't given up. They're continuing to put out pretty good efforts. There are times where pitching just is not giving them the opportunity. We saw a little bit of that yesterday, but I think it is a good sign that they're able to go out. Now, they just took 2-3 from the Reds. Before that, they split that four-game series against the Pirates. But, yeah, they had won three in a row before yesterday, so that's good to see.
Yeah, and the A's are in town. That game is at 1:15 today, 12:20 for the pregame show here on KMOX. Jimmy Crooks, the rookie catcher's first hit yesterday. It was a home run. Highly touted rookie in the Cardinals system, one of our top prospects. Cardinals have a log jam at the catching position. Pedro Pages in the month of August has been entirely respectable in the way he's handled himself. Cardinals have something of a catching glut going into next season.
Yeah, and that's not a terrible thing. Derek Gould wrote something about Pedro Pages and some adjustments that he had made. Actually, Thomas Ajayi, according to Derek's story, which you can read in the Post-Dispatch and STL Today, Thomas Ajayi had seen him in the minor leagues and basically said, "Hey, why aren't you doing this anymore?" And he started doing it, and then here in the month of August, he's really been hitting. He's one of the top hitters in all of Major League Baseball. We'll see whether or not this lasts or not. Pages has never been really a guy who's been known for his bat. He's always been a defense-first catcher. But to your point, they have so much coming from behind them. You got to figure out now what you have with Jimmy Crooks. And when I say now, I mean this season and next season, because Leonardo Bernal is going to be right behind him. And then Ronald Rodriguez, one of the top prospects in all of baseball, is behind him. So they've got a lot of catching depth right now. I probably would just completely stay away from Ivan Herrera ever being a catcher again. He hasn't shown the ability to stay healthy, so I would just rather see him be a DH, and he can play a little bit of left field on occasion, and you go forward. And this isn't anything against Joel Pozo, but Pozo had really, really cooled down here recently. His numbers in the month of August, he was hitting like 130, I think it was, somewhere around there. So this is a really great opportunity to get Jimmy Crooks into the big leagues and start to see what exactly you have in him, because I still think there's a little bit of question. He is the number six prospect in the organization, but there's still some question. Is this guy a kind of guy who can be a top-line catcher, or is this somebody who projects out to be a major league backup? You can start to find that out right away.
Well, I'm not sure they've announced the lineup today to know who is going to be catching, but whoever the catcher is will be catching Sonny Gray today. That's always a good day for the Cardinals.
More often than not, it is, for sure. He's the guy who gives you the best chance to win. He's had a couple moments here as the season has went along that, you know, he had a 7.81 ERA in the month of July. But his month of August, he always, this is very normal for him. He historically struggles in July and then comes back out and has a solid August, and that's what he's having right now. He's got a sub 3.5 ERA in the month of August. Of his five starts, four of them have been pretty good, and I still think there's a lot of questions about him moving forward. Is he somebody that's still 100% totally committed to being with the Cardinals, or if they went to him again in the offseason and said, hey, are you willing to get moved to a contender? I think there might be an opportunity that he would now say yes to that. I'm not sure, but at least for today, it's good to see Sonny Gray on the mound.
I've been really interested in the back end of the bullpen since the trade deadline. Ryan Helsley moves on. He's been horrible for the Mets. They're not using him as a closer, and perhaps that mentally that's part of it. Steven Matt's been pretty good for Boston. Phil Maton's moved on. But they've been replaced in the back end. Jojo Romero's been there all season. But between Kyle Leahy and Matt Swanson and Riley O'Brien, who's been hurt of late, you know, the Cardinals really, at least on the back end of the bullpen, haven't lacked much since that trade deadline.
No, they haven't, and it's been fun to see, and there's a lot of guys there that have very exciting arms. I'm really disappointed in the news that we've gotten over the last day or so that O'Brien may end up on the injured list, because that's always been something that he has struggled with, just the ability to stay healthy, and the way he has pitched all of a sudden started to create a scenario where you're thinking, hey, this guy might be somebody that you can, as you're looking to see who might be the closer next season, O'Brien could be in that conversation. Well, does that conversation change a little bit because he continues to not show the ability to stay healthy? I don't know. I just that's something that you do have to think about. Matt Swanson's been the guy for me who I've just been most excited about and most pleased with his performance. He is somebody who's pitching at a really high level, who's coming into games in tough spots, who's coming up with big strikeouts when he needs them. And, you know, there's some other guys in there as well. You know, Andre Granillo is somebody who's been fun to watch develop a little bit. He hasn't been quite as good here recently. Gordon Graceffo's had his moments this year. Even Ryan Fernandez the other day, as much as Fernandez has struggled all season long, he was able to go out and throw a scoreless inning when they needed him to in a save situation where a couple guys were down. You know, Kyle Leahy's been there all year long. He's done a really, really nice job. I still think his long-term future might be as a starter, but it's been good to see what he can do. You mentioned Jojo Romero. He's the guy who's getting a lot of the opportunities to save games right now. So, yeah, no, I do think one area where the organization is now lacking a bit because of this is that Memphis shuttle doesn't have the depth. Earlier this year when it was the Matt Swansons of the world that were going up and down, well, now they've got secure jobs on the Major League roster. So you're looking to see who else is going to be on that list of guys who can go up and down a little bit, and it feels like that's where maybe the team's been impacted by the trades because they just don't have that depth.
Well, we're clearly in the middle of a retool slash rebuild. Next year doesn't look particularly bright at this point. Bullpen arms, you know, are fickle. They come and go. Guys have good years. You think about a Hennessy Cabrera a few years ago, or Gallegos, who was really hot for a while and then dissipated. And that's the nature of the bullpen. But the starting pitching, looking ahead, I mean, you know, you've got McGreevy, maybe Sonny Gray stays. You've got Libertor, who's been shaky as of late. And then Pallante, who's been awful as of late. And Michaelis is gone. The Cardinals, as we look ahead, if they don't add in the offseason, they're going to potentially have a tough time putting a solid five-man rotation together, aren't they?
Yeah, that's the number one red flag when you look to next season. So even if you have – and I think Matthew Libertor is going to be fine. I think what we're seeing right now is just the case of a guy who's never been pushed this hard, kind of hitting a wall at the end of the season. And right now, the number one goal for Libertor is for him to try to find a way to make it through the season, continue to pitch every fifth day, so you kind of stretch him out as much as you can, and then go into an offseason hopefully healthy, and his body can recover and go into next year, and his body can be ready to handle the grind that is the 162-game season. So I know what it's looked like for Libertor recently, and his last start wasn't bad. That's a guy that I'm not concerned with right now. I think this is just part of being, you know, stretched out and being pushed more than you've ever been pushed before. I would not be giving Andre Pallante just an assumed job coming out of spring training next year. I think he has to compete for his job. I am much more concerned with what we've seen from Pallante than I am with what we've seen from Liberatore. You mentioned Sonny Gray. Michael McGreevy's been really good, but when you think about who Michael McGreevy is, and this isn't a shot at him, I mean, he's a number three, number four starter kind of guy on a really good team, and that's good. Like, that's, I say that, and it sounds like I'm putting him down. I'm not. That's exactly what you want from a guy that you've developed yourself and has the profile that McGreevy has, and he has pitched quite well this year, and I think he can continue to do that. Quinn Matthews will definitely be in the mix in spring training next year, but he's a guy who's going to go into spring training in all likelihood having never pitched a big league inning. I think at some point next season we'll be talking about Liam Doyle, who they just drafted this year, but I don't think he's somebody who's going to be competing for a job in spring. So what that tells you is this team, either they're going to have to trade or sign, I think they're going to have to acquire something, and I don't want it to be a situation like they had with Kyle Gibson and Lance Lynn last year, because those guys were making $11, $12 million a year, and when I talk about the value of Michael McGreevy, that's what I'm talking about, because he's one of those guys, and he's cost controlled, and he's come up through the system. So they're going to be active in this offseason. They're going to trade some guys. Maybe in one of these trades they're able to get a starting pitcher that can be competing for a job. But this is a really long answer to a short question, and I apologize. But when you really break things down for next year, there are huge question marks for the starting rotation.
Yeah, and you look at Kyle Gibson and Lance Lynn, it's like getting underwear on Christmas. I mean, you got to have it. You got to have a package wrapped up under the tree, but it's underwear. And that's kind of what you're talking about. So I want to shift, Matt, real quick.
I like that.
Yeah, thank you. So we saw the first look at our 2025 Mizzou Tigers on Thursday night. They defeated Parkway West 60-something to 7, I think it was. And, you know, this Pribula guy, the quarterback, Sam Horn, of course, goes down. But Bo Pribula looked good, both as a passer and as a runner. We don't really know about the defense yet because they played Parkway West. But what do you make of this program? What do you look at the possibilities for the Mizzou Tigers in the SEC this year?
Yeah, I think they're a team that can go out and be in the neighborhood of 9 or 10 wins again, and if things start to fall in the right direction, maybe we're looking at I think the absolute ceiling for this team is them kind of sneaking into the college football playoff, which would be amazing. And the floor for this team is still a really solid season with a nice bowl game. And I don't agree with the people that didn't vote them into the top 25 to open up the season. I think they are a top 25 team. We know that playing in the SEC is an absolute challenge, and you play really good teams every week. It's going to be fun to see them against Kansas next week. I think they beat Kansas, but that's their toughest game here in the non-conference. As far as their SEC schedule isn't terrible as it sits right now. The only teams that are currently in the top 25 that they're going to match up against are South Carolina, who looked really, really good yesterday, Alabama, who looked terrible against Florida State and lost to an unranked team, and then Oklahoma, who looked okay in the first week of the season. They were in the kind of in that same spot as Missouri was. They played Illinois State, so they weren't really tested. But without a doubt, I think this is a Missouri team that we are used to seeing them win 10 games or so every year, and I don't see why they can't do the same type of thing this season.
He is the sports fella, Matt Pauley, kind enough to join us here on the Chris and Amy Show with John and Mike, and you'll be with us later today as we have Cardinal baseball at 1:15. Sonny Gray takes them on. When Hancock and Kelly come back, we will visit about the president wants to do away with mail-in voting. It helped them. What's that all about? After this, Game Wax. Hey there, and happy Labor Day. It's Hancock and Kelly sitting in for Chris and Amy.
Yeah, we are.
We're going to go to the We have some of the most informed listeners out there.
Oh, there's nobody better. That's why everybody wants to work at the Voice of St. Louis, because right. the listeners, the callers, are so right. amazing.
And earlier we were discussing the bike races that I saw yesterday in on the Hill, which my yeah. understanding are up in Florissant
this
afternoon.
Hundreds of bicyclists running around.
And we had a conversation. I said, listen, these bikers are whipping around there, yeah. you know, 30, 45, 50 miles an hour.
Yeah.
And you thought I was being silly and didn't know what I was talking about.
I did.
We have a listener that probably knows the truth.
All right, let's find out. Anna, welcome aboard. Yes. You're on KMOX.
Well, thank you. Yes, they do go really fast on the straightaways and the sprints. They do go at least 30 miles an hour, maybe faster. Mm. And there's four races that they do in this Gateway Cup Classic.
Yeah.
First race was at Lafayette Park. Mm-hmm. And a shameless plug, my son got third. So
hey, what's his name?
Jason Roche.
Jason. And, congratulations, Jason. The old bronze medal at the bike race.
Yeah, yeah. And he rides with a group called Road Crew.
The Road Crew.
And then the next race on Saturday was at Francis Park.
Beautiful.
Then
area.
Yesterday was down on the Hill,
yeah.
and his teammate got first place there. Oh. So
killing
his,
it out there.
His name was Matt.
The Road Crew sounds like they're good.
They're very good.
Yeah, yeah. And today they'll race in Florissant. But
are you going?
Yeah, they get they're fast.
You go?
They're very fast.
Are you going today?
Oh, yes.
Yeah, of course.
Mom Jason, and Dad, we go to all four races.
Road crews out there.
They're professionals, right? They're racing for money?
Oh, yes.
Yes.
Yes. Well, they have all different levels and different amounts of money. They have professional women. But these are local, national, and international riders.
Whoa.
They come in from Germany, Colombia, out of the country they come in. So this is a big deal.
Better watch out for ice out there.
When Jason was first learning how to ride a bike as a toddler, when you took the training wheels off, could you tell immediately, uh-oh, we got one of them. He's going to be racing these things.
I don't know, but my husband, he took him out in the park, and the wheels were off, and he put him out on the grass. And he thought, if you fall, you're in the park, you're not going to hurt yourself. And yeah, I guess that was the start of it. And he's been biking ever since.
Now
he'll do all kinds of bike races.
Look at him now. He's got the bronze medal around his neck.
Let me just tell you, these guys are fit, John. First of all, they don't weigh anything. They have to eat a lot of calories, and they're just they're real
athletes,
muscular.
Michael, they're athletes. You know, my bicycle race team was called the Roadkill.
The Road Kill.
Back in the day. And, now I want to settle this speed question, because my buddy Michael was talking about these bicyclists going 50 miles.
They whip around.
And I said, let's roll the tape back, James. Never mind. I said they go about 25 miles an hour. Who is closer between 25 and 50 and projecting how fast these bikes go, Hannah?
Oh, I would say about at least 30.
30. Okay, so 25 is closer to 30.
Maybe a little more.
32. 25 is closer to 32 than 32 is to 50 is all I'm going to say.
John Hancock, could you even ride a bicycle?
Buddy.
I know you've done it in your life, but when was the last time you were on a bicycle?
Well, I'll tell you, I had a bad experience with the banana seat.
Family radio.
Are they using banana seats on these bikes out there, Anna?
Oh, no. These are some hard seats. They have some of them have cushions, but they stand up at the end.
They stand up on the bikes.
Well, towards the end, they do for a sprint.
Does he do wheelies during the course of a race?
No. Okay. Oh, my gosh. No.
What a silly question.
They're so close and on top of each other, you can't make a mistake, otherwise you have a wipeout.
No wipeouts.
On turn two yesterday,
they
were having wipeouts. So, it's...
what happens if you wipe out? Do you just get back on the bike and go?
Well, actually, if they have a bunch of folks there that if they can bend your bike back, because these are carbon fiber, if they can put them back in shape, they'll put them back on the bike. They can join the end of the race once it comes around again, the end of the lap, I should say.
Yeah, yeah.
And then you've got to work your way back up if you want to get to the front.
That's America right there, ladies
but
and gentlemen.
But if you're hurt, of course, they'll maybe have to cart you off and get some help.
Next gladiator, you know, please.
Never want to be carted off. But that's America. You fall off the bike, you go to the end of the line.
Yeah.
And then you make your way back.
Well, this
that's
is
right.
This
that's
has
right.
been a very enlightening conversation.
Anna, I can't even begin to thank you enough for the contributions you have added here to the public airwaves of KMOX.
Well, thank you, and I enjoy listening to both of you.
Thanks, Anna.
You're in a very select club there, Anna, and we appreciate
you. You tell it like it is, and you make me laugh. So you're great.
How about
thank
that?
You.
That's exactly what my wife says.
Speaking of laughing, I want to know the last time you got on a bike. It's been more than 10 years.
Well,
it's been more than 20 years.
Thank you, Anna. And by the way, just the other day, I did manage to get down onto Tula's tricycle.
Well, that doesn't count.
Well, that does. We're trying to teach her to pedal. So right now, she's doing the Fred Flintstone, with the tricycle.
Moves her legs, yeah.
Yeah, and so we're trying to get her to put those little feet in the little pedal things and,
So you got down there to kind of show her what it would look like?
I showed her what it would look like.
Did you look like a circus clown?
I looked like...
a little small tricycle?
I looked like Doodles that I used to work with at Six Flags. What a great clown this guy was.
Yeah.
Doodles a clown.
Grown man.
300 pounds.
No way.
Yeah, well, he maybe 280. But he was full clown attire, including the shoes. I mean, the oversized, the man could drive a tricycle up and down the hills at Six Flags like nobody's ever seen. I mean, it was, when I think about athletic feats, you think about Carl Lewis in the Olympics. You think about Bruce Jenner, God rest his soul, doing the triathlon or pentathlon, whatever it was, the octapathon. And you think about Doodles the Clown. On that tricycle did things that no human being I've seen do since or before. But that's a story for another day. Michael Kelly and John Hancock, we got weather to tell you about when we come back. Michael, it's Labor Day. We're going to enjoy the labor movement from my friend who knows the labor movement in this country better than anybody I've ever met, Michael Kelly. That's next on KMOX.
Adios. Hey, it's Hancock and Kelly sitting in for Chris and Amy. This is a fact I didn't know. Do you realize that Labor Day has been an official holiday in the United States since 1894?
Yes.
That's when 30 United States states, U.S. states were already officially celebrating Labor Day. And the year shortly after the Pullman strike, the Congress passed a bill recognizing the first Monday of September as Labor Day.
President in 1894?
Grover Cleveland?
Yes!
Hey, now.
Wow.
Impressive, right?
Yes.
Did not see
that coming.
Yeah, Labor Day also is in conjunction with May Day, which is a holiday celebrating workers around the world. And Labor Day's always been Christmas Day in the Kelly house, Bob. John, I grew up in a labor household. And right now, most of my life, organized labor has been getting smaller. The amount of members that are a part of organized labor has been shrinking.
It really dates back to the early 1980s.
Yeah, since the AFL and the CIO, the American Federation of Labor, and the Congress of Industrial Organizations united, that was their biggest day. They've been getting smaller ever since. But the stature and the role of organized labor continues to grow, and I would argue in this upcoming political season, maybe at the highest it's ever been. I can't recall a time when both parties, both the Democrats, as of late, traditional supporters of organized labor, and now the Republicans, find themselves out fighting for the support and endorsements of organized labor.
Yeah, and it corresponds with the voting patterns of organized labor members had been the second most reliable voting bloc for Democrats for decades, going back to at least the 1960s, it's certainly from the 1960s through recent times. But in recent times, I think you've seen an increasing number of labor households who have been voting Republican. And not just as it relates to Donald Trump, but certainly exacerbated by Donald Trump, who's had a particular appeal to a lot of blue-collar workers for a myriad of different reasons. And so as you've seen that allegiance by the rank and file themselves begin to shift, you've seen the parties begin to increasingly, both parties, increasingly embrace organized labor.
Which is interesting, right? Missouri is a good example of this.
It was just
5 or 6 years ago that Josh Hawley was supportive of efforts for a right-to-work law that would have banned organizing and forced, you know, forced right-to-work laws in the state of Missouri. As a result, though, he's out walking picket line. You'll remember, John, we had the strike out at GM. We saw Josh Hawley, a Republican senator, out walking the picket line. We, of course, have the ongoing strike work stoppage that's taking place out at Boeing here in St. Louis. And that now is going almost to a month since that began. They announced earlier last week that they wouldn't be back to the bargaining table until after Labor Day. So one kind of scratches their head as to whether or not that strike may go on.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about that. So this is the machinists, right? At Boeing. And so the dispute has to do with wages and then benefits as well?
Right.
Or is it primarily
wages and benefits? So if you'll remember, about 12, 18 months ago, we had the big UPS strike or contract that came out, and their biggest contract ever came out. Then we had Boeing is essentially two companies. There's the commercial aircraft, and there's the military defense. Mm-hmm. Here in St. Louis, we are military defense. Out in Seattle, it's commercial aircraft. They had a strike out in Seattle that went almost 45 days, fighting about the same things. And it has to do with wages and seniority as these jobs are changing and evolving. You have such a young workforce coming in with a much older workforce that already exists. So you've got this push and pull that takes place over wages. Hey, should we put more in our 401k or can I take more into my take home pay? And that's just one of the struggles that happens.
I'm guessing there's kind of a different of interest if you're an older worker versus a younger.
Right. If you're in your 50s or above, you're more interested in seniority, pension and protections. And hey, if they're going to throw a couple of more quarters into our 401k, that means more to me.
Right.
If you're under the age of 35, you're out there saying, hey, man, I got student loans.
Show me the money.
Yeah, I need to be able to pay this. And that's just a struggle that's taking place. And, I mean, workers across the country are rejecting contracts at first. And we're also seeing workers get the largest pay increases they've ever gotten. But, John, many of them saying they can't keep up with inflation. No surprise, right? The largest gap ever recorded this year, 667% difference between the CEO and the average worker pay in the United States. I can remember when it was 25 and 30 times. Mm. 667% difference now. The CEO at Starbucks making $50, $60 million, an average employee making the minimum wage. So it's no surprise that labor is kind of bubbling up in this election as we see income disparity continue to be a problem, and inflation on the rise, tariffs, which in the past had been an issue that organized labor kind of embraced. Our own Dick Gephardt was a huge person who quarterbacked that. It was Republicans and conservative thought that always stopped that. So I think on this Labor Day, organized labor and workers, in a sense, find themselves as the sexy object of this upcoming election that's in the middle of a blender because nothing's really making sense.
Yeah, you know, boy, this is a bit of a rabbit trail, but I'm going to go there because we got to fill time here.
Yeah, we do. We're here until noon.
So I've never been one that's particularly been concerned about income gaps.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the very wealthy, the folks at the top are going to make a whole lot of money, and I think deservedly so, and they're governed by, in most cases, a board of directors. So the income disparity I don't view as a huge macroeconomic issue in the country, but what I do view as a huge economic issue is the winnowing of the middle class, because what has been the foundation of the prosperity that this country has uniquely known in the history of mankind has been a large and thriving and upwardly mobile middle class. And so, you know, what happens on the ends, the far, far end of the high end and the far, far end on the low end is one thing. But if you begin to see a middle class that begins shrinking and the purchasing power and the upward mobility of that middle class begins dissipating, then I think you are looking at some structural economic conditions that don't bode well for this country. And I do worry that some of the policies that we've been enacting, both parties, by the way, have really played a role in going at the middle class. And that, I do believe, is
a
problem.
Yeah, but John, as we continue to saturate the corporate suites of every company in this country, at the same time, the same workers are still showing up to work. You talk about the gutting of the middle class. Yeah, we're saturating the court, you know, the C-suite with millions of dollars. We're taking away those middle class jobs. And now with AI,
yep,
it's likely that it will even speed up.
Yes.
Because if you're an engineer, an accountant, even a lawyer, I don't know, a political consultant, you find yourself in a job right now that a computer isn't a threat to you. That's about to change.
Yeah.
And so we're still going to need people to pick things up and take them from here to there. And then we're going to saturate the people in the C-suite. Guess what goes away? That's your middle class income disparity.
Well, those are real challenges that we face. And then you lay the policies that have been enacted on top of that. And the one thing I've evolved since you and I have known each other.
Right, ditto.
I've evolved in my opinion of organized labor. I was not a fan of organized labor years ago when I first entered politics. And part of that was because they were always, you know,
voting against you.
Yeah, but and spending money. But if you step back and take a look, and I'm specifically thinking about the trades, folks that are building things, operating cranes, doing labor. The organized labor in this country, historically, has been a major component of building a middle class. People who are making a wage, it's livable, they can save some money, they can put their kids in school, there's a whole lot of things they're able to do. They're able to take vacations a couple times. And organized labor, regardless of what you may think of it, has been vitally important in building and fostering and expanding the middle class in the United States of America. So for that, I salute our organized labor friends on this Labor Day.
And never forget, I mean, when I first started being conscious and aware, organized labor made up about 20% of the workforce in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
They represented about 20% of the workers. It's below 10% now of workers. But most of your contracts that are driven at UPS and at the auto places where organized labor, Anheuser-Busch, Schnucks, they wind up setting the wage rate even for those below them. And so they play a role in, even though they're small, they're quite mighty in that they bring the wage rates up for everyone.
How much has the right to work laws that have passed in between 30 and 40 states, maybe more, how much has that impacted membership in organized labor?
Well, it's devastating, particularly in those trades that you talked about, mm-hmm, which is the building and construction trades. And there's almost no, there's some organized workers throughout the South. Missouri's unique, right? The Republicans passed a right to work law. We overturned that here. The voters went over there and overturned the right to work. What does that mean? That means you get hired at a business, okay? You go apply for a job at Kelly Inc., right? And everybody at Kelly Inc. belongs to the union. When you show up, you automatically are a part of the union as a condition of employment. That's what right to work allows. If they put right to work laws in place, you couldn't automatically belong to the union. It would force a vote for everybody who was in there. And then you get what's called freeloaders. So you and I work at Kelly Inc. We're paying the union dues. James shows up. He doesn't want to pay the union dues.
Come on, James.
He gets the pay increase. He gets the insurance, everything that you and I help pay for. Right to work allows that law to say, hey, if you work at this place, you're automatically going to be a part of the union. And so it's devastating throughout the South, hence the reason that you got a lot of illegal construction that goes on. Mm. When you have the protections of a collective bargaining agreement like we see in Missouri and Illinois, you also have those workers' protections and safeties, and it keeps a lot of that illegal and less than trained workers from being on the job. Unions fight for the right things in life.
Nobody is more plugged into organized labor than my buddy Michael Kelly. When we come back, nobody is more plugged into the perfect preparation of the pork steak. As am I. And that's next on Camo X. Barracuda.
Nothing is open today, which means that your family probably will be waiting for you to mosey out with your tongs and and your charcoal briquettes.
Yes.
And
no, I don't have. I got the gas.
You got the gas, the gas stove.
Yeah, it's a lot easier to regulate the heat that way.
Now, what will be on the docket today? You say pork steak.
The pork steak, buddy. Yeah, the perfect meat.
No, it's not.
And because you've never had one lovingly and carefully prepared.
First of all, go ahead and explain to us how to lovingly and properly prepare a pork steak.
All right. So you take the magnificent piece of meat, and you prepare it. A little garlic, a little S&P.
Okay.
And maybe just a touch of olive oil.
Okay.
And flip that sucker, do the other side.
Mm-hmm.
And then you get that grill at right about 5 1/4.
Okay.
And you take that dog out there and you lay it on the grill and watch. The aroma, incredible, and you flip it. You cook it a little bit, you know.
But once it comes off the grill, it still has to be put into something to make it chewable.
The pan, buddy.
Yeah,
it's all about.
That's
the pan.
Why this is not a good piece of meat.
No.
When you have to cook it and then saturate it in something so that it will be soft,
sweet baby rays.
Yeah,
and in one of these about 2.5-inch saucepan.
Uh-huh.
And you lay those puppies out there.
Can of beer.
Put them in the oven at about 300, 3 1/4.
Mm-hmm.
You let them just baste into the
wound. Yeah, I'm sorry.
When they come out,
they've
got the barbecue singe. They've got the taste of all of the prep that you had placed on them. And they've got the running through, completely through the sweet baby rays.
Mm-hmm. So that they can be chewable.
And it's so soft and tender. You don't even need a steak knife for these things, Michael.
Of course, because they've been floating in juice.
Yes, and it's so good. And, man, you throw some little cheesy potatoes on with that.
Uh-huh.
Little cheesy potatoes. And then corn on the cob.
I'm sorry, man. Addition. I put pork steaks in the same thing as like venison. Everybody wants to convince you it's the greatest thing in the world. Why do I have to eat it? Why don't I just eat a regular steak? Why do I have to boil my meat?
My mouth
is water. I'm no longer
in
Ireland.
Buddy, you're not boiling your meat.
That's what you're doing.
No,
when you put it in the sauce, you're making it chewable.
You're not boiling your meat.
Yes, you are.
You are simmering that meat. And you're letting the succulent juices of the barbecue sauce.
A can of beer and barbecue sauce.
Magnificent piece of pork. And and they're big. These aren't, you go get a little filet mignon.
And the pork steak's got a bone in it, too.
Huh?
And the other thing about a pork steak is it has a bone in it.
And the meat closest to the bone
is
perhaps the most succulent thing ever tasted by a human
who
being.
Who wants to eat meat off a bone?
I do.
You do? Do you like gnawing on a bone? Don't you feel like an animal when you do that? Don't you feel like your dog?
No.
When you're eating around a piece of bone?
I do not feel like a dog when I'm eating around a piece of bone.
Yeah.
That's
How about when you're ripping your head side to side so that you can actually chew that pork steak because it's too chewy?
It's so tender. Yeah. You've never had one of my tender pork steaks, which I am going to have later on this very day. That's Michael Kelly, and I'm John Hancock. When we come back, the president's tariff policy was overturned by an appellate court last week, saying that most of the tariffs he's levied are unconstitutional. We'll have an expert to break it down next on KMOX.